And good morning, Apricot.
Good morning, Spence. How are you?
I'm good. Who are you?
I am tired. I'd just like to apologize to everybody for we are running behind today. It's entirely my fault. My alarms appear not to do anything anymore.
Have you tried turning them off and on?
I have. Unfortunately, I'm one of these people that gets used to their alarm tone. So I need to change it like every few months, basically, or else I will just start sleeping through it. And I think I've reached that point this time.
Well, that's it. That's interesting. I find I get attuned to that tone, and it becomes almost Pavlovian. I know this is a bit off topic,
I just get used to it. I'm just like, oh yeah, that's that tone.
So you're more like Apricot, are you?
No, I'm more like you in that regard. Like I'm the type of person, like, I think my alarm tone has been the same for a while. I just get so used to hearing it.
Yeah, look, same here. I've had the same alarm for several years now, and it's just ingrained there, which I'm sure my alarm is fascinating the people who came here to tune into politics. So sorry, Apricot, over to you.
So good. Well, we might just jump straight up into our first topic, which is, congratulations, Labor's climate policy has officially passed the House. It will likely pass the Senate fairly easily. Is this an end to the climate wars? Spence, we might throw to you.
I'm in the mindset of no, just because I feel like to fully end the climate wars, it's kind of like you need the ideological change within the side of politics that has been very much against it. And if you look at the comments made by people like John Howard and Tony Abbott of Myth Memory, it's pretty clear that there's still that group within the coalition that don't really take climate action seriously. And until that kind of era of politicians is out of that party, I felt this will constantly be an issue, and it will constantly be a thing that will keep going unless those mindsets change.
Right. It's understandable. What do you think, Ardy?
Oh, I think it's completely done. I don't expect to ever hear about it again.
Really?
God. I think there's so much emotion, energy, and passion about the climate, and they're much sought after fuel by politicians. They are there to be harnessed one way or the other, regardless of truth, regardless of reality. If you've got that out there, and you can harness the emotion, energy, and passion of a group of people, then it's a very powerful political tool. So given how deeply people feel about the climate, understandably we're surrounded by it, but given how deeply people feel about it, I think we're only just ramping up. I think there's I also think too there is a constant pressure that probably the left side of politics tends to understand a little bit more than the right side, talking in those broad generalizations. And that is that the left generally understand playing the game of inches. They'll get a success and then use that as a stake in the ground and move forward from there. Not quite sure what why there's not that same mindset on the right. As I said, we're talking very much in generalizations, but I do see that on the left. And I see someone like Bant, particularly, he strikes me as he's going to be particularly adept at using that strategy. He seems a very sort of strategic person. And as much as Labor are trying to, again, downplay the Greens' role, that stake's in the ground. They've established themselves. They're going to move to the next position of power in my opinion. And I expect we're just going to see this ramp up even further over the next few years.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement, essentially, that no, the climate wars are not over. I would just argue that they're entering a new phase, which is that, like, the initial, you know, battle, if you will, about, you know, is climate change real, has essentially been won. And just to come back to your point about stakes, you know, this 43% target policy of Labor's is a stake. And I think that's the signaling of the end of, like, the last, you know, basically, well, 10 years since the carbon price got removed by Tony Abbott, which, by the way, I know people love to talk about the CPRS. Boy, howdy, I know I do. but I do actually see Abbott removing the carbon price in 2013 as, like, the beginning of the climate wars for real. You know, like the CPRS was a failed policy, but there was still that push to include it, and we did get policy fairly soon after, like within a year afterwards, kind of thing.
Right.
But after its removal and subsequent Liberal governments, and there's been that fight, you know, in the climate wars, that's the first battle of the climate wars in my mind. But now we're entering in this new stage where, if I'm fairly honest, I don't feel that great for Labor in it, because they're basically going to have two battles on their hand. The coalition has pivoted to nuclear fairly heavily, and they're going to try and fight the next climate war battle on that. Whereas, so you've got that on one side, and then on the other, you now have the Greens pushing for a much harder exit from fossil fuels. And basically, both of those things Labor doesn't want to do. Labor doesn't want to touch nuclear because it's such a controversial topic. Labor doesn't want to get out of coal and gas, you know, by 2030 because they're worried about their rural and regional seats, essentially. We can talk about what impact the fossil fuel donations have on that impact as well. But, like, I think Labor would basically just like a status quo. Oh yeah, we're building some renewables. We're going to meet our 43% target in a canter. Can everyone please stop yelling at us?
And I feel like that's not what they're going to get.
No, they're not, though.
Looking at the way the politics is shaped up and how much climate change is such a big issue with a lot of people, them sticking to the status quo, I feel like, would be a death sentence to them. They may not lose to the coal, wishing out another election, but they're going to lose seats. And they're going to lose that full power that they have in the House of Reps. Because it's pretty clear that people give a shit about climate change. They want actual action. They want shit to be done. So doing the bare minimum and sticking with the status quo is just not going to be enough anymore. They could have gone away with it a couple elections ago, but at this point where we're reaching a point where 2030 is so close and those key targets are so close to a point where once you get past that, there's nothing else you can do kind of thing. A lot of people are like, no, you need to start doing stuff. Yes, the bare minimum's nice, but it's not enough. You have to keep going. And if Labor don't keep going, they're going to get crucified by it.
So you're sort of viewing that as, you think people are viewing it as, okay, well, now you've started, and even though Labor might claim, look, we've done 43% mentally for a lot of people, all they've done is set the clock to zero, and they want them to act further. Is that sort of what you mean?
Yeah, I kind of mean that. I think it's very much the thing of the 43% is good. It's something. I think everyone's happy that there's at least being something that is done. We're at least making it, pushing for something. They're always doing something to make things slightly better. It's kind of like, I'll be honest, when there's a fire, the best way to look at it is that Labor's basically at the moment just, there's about 10 buckets on the ground and they're throwing it at the fire. They're at least doing something, but it's not going to stop it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So more needs to be done. And people are wanting more to be done to basically save a lot of people.
It's funny you said... Sorry, go on.
Like, it's clear that if stuff doesn't get done, we're all up shit creek without a paddle.
Yeah, when you said that about the buckets, it reminded me of a mate of mine. He lived on a property as a kid, and one day he was telling me a story. He and his mate were playing with matches in the haystack, and the inevitable happened, and it caught a light. And he said one of his clear memories, aside from in those days, the belting he received for doing it, one of his clear memories was standing there with his friend and his father as they watched the haystack burn, and his mother came running out with a bucket of water and gave it to the father, and the father just looked at it and looked at her and said, "Where do you want me to throw it?" It just always always stuck in my head, and you just reminded me of that, Spence. People be standing there saying, "Well, that's great, but all you're doing is throwing a bucket of water on a burning haystack."
Yeah. The other thing as well that it's worth remembering is that a lot of that 43% target will be carried by the states. It doesn't require much federal policy, really, in a way. And then there's going to be a really key kind of moment in October where the Greens are going to attempt to amend Albo's budget, okay, to remove any kind of public money going to fossil fuels.
Right.
And now I can say that amendment is probably going to fail because Labor and Liberal won't support it. I doubt Labor just on principle would really support their budget being amended at all. But that's going to be a really powerful image to a lot of the like inner city voters and things like that. When you have like the Greens, Pocock, maybe Jackie Lambie on one side, and then you have Labor, the Coalition, and One Nation on the other, basically supporting money for fossil fuels. Because Labor, unfortunately, in this new era of climate wars, basic fact goes against them, and which is a very unfortunate situation to be in when you're a politician trying to get your messaging out there. There's that line that Bant uses as much as possible, which is like, you don't put out a fire by pouring more petrol on it.
Yeah.
Which is essentially a fact. Like, we're not going to solve climate change by doing more fossil fuels. And I think the ALP is going to have a really hard time justifying that to the public.
Yeah, I can see that. I think it's a hard sell. It's something that, despite how you could reasonably argue a transition, it's got so much narrative attached to it from both sides. You know, it's not just a single side doing the thing. Fossil fuels have got two very strong narratives attached to them, and Labor have attached themselves to that subject.
Yeah. So, in summary, climate wars are not over. New battles. It's not going to be fun for whoever's ever trying to manage that, which at this moment is Labor.
Yeah.
And look, you had a couple of points too. There was a couple of points too that came up as a result of that, which I wouldn't mind raising for you. But just quickly jump over to the comments in the chat. We've got one from Jeffo, 12345. We're still going through the Anthropocene and millions of hectares of bush have been cleared. It's going to take a couple more measures than waiting for the free market to stop that kind of eco-destruction. Probably 2 decades, if not more, of climate war. What I assume is a g'day from FlimsyAd8427. Another one from one of our regulars. I think the Teals will hold Labor to account on climate. Labor cannot afford to lose more votes to the Teals at the next election. It was the Teals that got Labor to make the most changes to the bill. Jeffo also added, the Minerals Council also bankrolled ads to get rid of Labor in 2013. Now the Minerals Council has backed Labor's plan for this parliament. Very interesting difference. And in fact, that's one of the points that I was going to go on to. Enoch Isaac has also said, where is aged care going? I don't know if we'll get to that today, but that point that you raised, I just wanted you to elaborate on, Apricot. I think it was you or Spence that raised it, the fossil fuel donations. You wanted to make a comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but I'm actually, sorry, Jeffo, I'm not going to address that comment. What I'm going to address is Betalongs about the Teals, because I think it's really important to highlight this. So, again, his comment was, you know, I think the Teals will hold Labor to account on climate. They got, like, the most changes to the bill, and Labor can't afford to lose more votes to the Teals at the next election. That is a false narrative, really. The ALP has gone out of their way to highlight the Teals' involvement in their climate bill, because the Teals at the moment in Parliament are functionally irrelevant. Labor has majority. So, like, you know, if the Teals don't support something, Albert can tell them to go jump in a lake. It doesn't matter. However, most of those Teals, in fact, I think all of those Teals, no. Do we count Dai Li as a Teal, by the way, who took the seat of Fowler?
I feel like no, because I feel like Dai Li tends to... she feels more liberal, like feels more like a Liberal Party member than an actual Teal, especially with the kind of the fact that she no voted, she didn't vote on this. It feels like it kind of she goes against what the common definition of a Teal independent is, which is a Liberal Party that is very conscious of climate. So economically right, but climately and progressively liberal, kind of
right.
And I don't think she fits that.
Yeah, I'd agree. But so most of the Teals, then, like the people that were counting, you know, Monique Ryan, Zoe Daniel, Allegra Spedra, those are the main ones I can remember off the top of my head, won their seats off the Liberals. And it's an easy, it's almost an easy win for Labor at the next election. That, like, Labor will form some sort of government if those Teals retain those seats. And so I think the ALP will be championing some of those Teals quite heavily over the next 3 years to be like, no, look, see, they are doing stuff, guys. You know, you might want to stick with your Teal rather than coming back to a moderate Liberal if the Liberals manage to get their crap together.
And I think Albert's Labor has probably facing more danger from Greens than they are from the Teal Independents, because the Greens have shown that they can beat Labor in Labor heartland seats. And that more people, if they're going to be disenfranchised by Labor, they're going to go to the Greens.
I think that is a real danger. But yeah, so I think it's a bit of a false narrative to basically say Labor's got to be careful of the teams. I don't think there's that many Teal and Labor contests for them to be careful of. And
again, yeah, look, I tend to agree with what you and Spence are saying there. A couple of years is a long time in politics, as the old cliche goes. I wouldn't completely rule out the Teals becoming more coherent and becoming a threat. I'm in agreement with you. I don't think that's the case now, but I wouldn't heavily bet against it in a 2 or 3 year projection.
I think it's more likely to be will the current coalition move closer to where the Teals are and join up back with them, basically? Or will it reach a point where the coalition moves too far one way, and then there's a possibility that Teal is basically becoming the new coalition party?
Well, I personally don't think that'll happen, mainly because the Teals seem to be hell-bent on not doing that. But I think that also segues us, though, into our second topic, news poll, because Peter Dutton was polling, what, 25% on the preferred prime minister rail or something? Like this, the last news poll that came out last week for the ALP was significantly good. I think that 4% prompt in primary from the election maybe a bit smaller than they were expecting, but in all, like, Albo's approval ratings are fairly high. Dutton's pretty low, surprise, surprise. Yeah, and like, it's really, I think we are very much in the honeymoon period for the government still.
Yep.
And I just think that's very interesting to talk about. Guys, what do you think?
Yeah, look, I understand the honeymoon period. However, there was an article in The Australian, record electoral satisfaction rating for Anthony Albanese. That was by Simon Benson. And there was one paragraph that stood out for me, which relates to that point that you just made. The paragraph was, mm-hmm. The strong show of electoral goodwill for the Albanese government comes despite the energy and inflation crises that have dominated the political landscape over the past 2 months. The reason it stood out for me is that, yes, there is that honeymoon period. However, they're very, very strong forces that people feel about, and I think it actually shows, at this point, that's a big sign of strength for the Albanese government, that the energy, the inflation, and the economic as well, that they can be weighing so heavily on us. They're also getting pushed by the media, and that Albanese can still get such a high result. My personal opinion is, at this stage, that's highly positive for him, and I tend to agree with you that it's probably reasonable for them to have expected it to be higher. So I just thought that was interesting that they could show that strength against that sort of opposition.
I think it also kind of helps with this current Albanese government is that they haven't done anything generally that could be viewed as not good. Because they've played it kind of safe and smart with it, they've not done anything to piss people off yet, and especially after we've had 3 years of one government, literally once a week, something coming out of them doing something not great and annoying people. I think when you have a situation where you've got a government that seems to be doing their job and is actually doing things, I think it's hard to really be like, you're not doing a good job. It's like, well, you technically are.
I don't know if I would say that they haven't done anything wrong to piss people off. I'd just say that it hasn't really cut through. Like, I immediately go to, like, some of the changes they made with Medicare, about, like, phone appointments and whatnot. And cancelling free rats and stuff. It's not a decision I would have really expected a Labor government to have made. But, like, they did. But I also think that at this stage, kind of, like, things aren't going to stick to the government for a little while. They're going to slide off in that ooze of honey, unless it's something fairly major.
Yeah, look, I think that's a reasonable comment at this point. And, there's always a movement to wanting to get a quick result and a quick click and things go on to the next one, but really they're sort of entitled to a couple, in my opinion, entitled to a couple more months to find their feet.
I think also adding to what kind of Apricot said there, and kind of with that, I think it also helps that they don't have anyone that's really, at the moment, besides on those issues, no one's really holding them accountable, especially in Parliament. Most of everyone else is looking at climate bills, whereas, as you, like, those kind of things, they've just kind of been missed.
But But Peter Dutton got up in Question Time like 3 or 4 days in a row and talked about the CFMEU, right? Like, wow, being held to account.
Well, so can you elaborate that on that a little bit, Spence? You're saying that at the moment you don't feel like anyone is holding them to account, or are you saying the Parliament, how it's structured, there's probably not going to be anyone to hold them account, or were you just talking about a particular issue?
Those particular issues mainly. I think I was mainly just talking about kind of the rat stuff and the Medicare stuff and the phone consultation stuff.
Mm.
Because at the moment, because there's so many other, I hate to say it, bigger issues that politicians are focusing on more, those types of things are just going to get swept under the rug and missed. So no one's actually going to be specific about it and bring it up in Question Time or in Parliament, because there's other issues that have just kind of taken precedence.
Right. Mm. Okay.
Okay. I think what Ardeet said about, you know, giving them a couple more months is probably fair. I think we will know. I think we'll really start to see after the budget, kind of thing.
Yep.
And it's going to be a really interesting time.
Yeah. Look, I think I agree with you that the budget is probably where I'd put the line in the sand. Because let's face it, we've had a long period of the coalition. It's a big ship to turn around, government, and the budget is really going to be where they can actually make a statement in the most concrete way that a government can make the statement in, that is economically. You know, once you can have all the words you like, but once you come down to what are you putting your money on, what are you betting on, that's when people can start judging you by something a little bit more concrete. So I think I'm not saying they should be getting let off the hook or shouldn't be held to account, but for me, when the budget comes out, that's when they're off and running and don't have the excuse of looking back.
Yeah. It's also worthwhile pointing out that the budget is around the time when some, shall we say, non-policy wonks will pay a little bit more attention since the election. You know, like they'll stick their head up and be like, oh yeah, what's all this then?
Yep.
And it's also, there's that news cycle around it where, you know, news stations and articles feel the absolute need to go, who are the winners and the losers in the budget?
Yes.
So, yeah. That'll be really interesting to see when it comes out.
Well, yeah.
If it's all right with you guys, I might move on to our third and final topic of the day, which is, guys, why are the Victorian Liberals so shit?
It's honestly laughable how bad they are.
Sorry, what was that?
Honestly laughable how bad they are.
Ah, yes. Yes, Adi.
I was going to hear say, let's hear your comment first, but Spence jumped in because I know they're not your favourite. No, they're not. In fact, why don't you lead the two of us into this topic?
So, for a while, the Victorian Liberals were called like the jewel in the Liberals' crown. You know, we had Jeff Kennett. The Victorian Liberals were really strong in Victoria. But it seems, especially over the last decade, basically with the demise of the Natthine government, things are not looking great for them. There's been times, I believe, where they've essentially been bankrupt, which is, I think, one of those times is now. I think they're looking to lease part of their headquarters out so they can make some rent money. Mm. They've lost a lot of donors. They've lost a lot of members. Arguably, the party's been pulled further right wing. And I think really just after the federal election, where the Victorian, like the Liberals got kind of decimated in Victoria, and Teals won a bunch of, you know, previously affluent, moderate Liberal seats. And not only that, but it was probably some of the strongest Teal push, you know, with Ryan and Daniel. Mm-hmm. It's like their position is really not great. They lost in a landslide in 2018. They replaced Matthew Guy with Michael O'Brien, who most of you have probably forgotten existed because he was so invisible.
I'm glad you reminded me of the name.
Then they got Matthew Guy back in. And can you believe it? They were apparently planning on fighting this next state election on the issue of integrity and holding the government to account. And a source within the party has said that they held that moral high ground for about 2 days before it came out that Matthew Guy's chief of staff was soliciting like extra payments from donors and such.
Yeah, I saw that story. I thought, well, yeah, that was into the bin pretty quickly.
And the other thing as well is there's another, you know, insider into the party where they're like, the only reason why Matthew Guy is still a leader at this point is there's no one to replace him. There's no natural successor because they're just so bereft of talent at the moment. So, guys, what's gone wrong with the Victorian Liberals?
Well, bereft of talent. No, you go ahead, Spitz.
No, I was going to say that. Like as you said, there's no one there. There's no one good, and I think there's also the. I think they got very comfortable. I think they got too comfortable in the fact of that they've got that history behind them. They thought, well, yeah, things would be easy. We'll do all this, but what's ended up happening is that that's blown up in their face, and now they're left with no one who's actually skilled enough to lead the party, because there's no leadership there. There's no one that's actually going to bring all of them together and have a clear kind of lead or guide on what they need to do. And at the moment, they're just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks, and they've been doing that for a while, and it's pretty clear that that is not working. It's not going to work and continue to not work, because there's no real thought behind it. And I think it also doesn't help that they've got people in their party that are basically just a cancer to their party. And until they're fully cut out, things are not going to get better. And when you have constant controversies, especially with the federal Liberal Party, that's always going to weigh back on, especially if a state-level party is also bringing in controversies, and then you've got New South Wales Liberals who've got controversy after controversy. All of that's just going to compound to people just not really trusting you and not really liking you. So unless someone steps up and tries to change that image, nothing's going to change.
True. However, I would point out that despite all their flaws, the New South Wales Liberal Party does somehow seem to have it shit a bit together more than the Victorian Liberals.
To be fair, that's not a hard comparison.
yeah, okay. Oh, dear.
Yeah, look, I thought it was interesting to see the... was it? There was an article in the Spectator Australia. Make of that what you will. But there was an article in the Spectator Australia by James McPherson. It was an opinion piece titled "Victorian Liberals Left of Labor." There's a couple of paragraphs in that, and I like this first sentence. In a desperate bid to remain in opposition, state Liberal leader Matthew Guy yesterday announced an emissions reduction target even more radical than the federal government's. Anything to give a snowflake a chance in hell. Rather than defending civil rights trampled by the Andrews government during the first wave of COVID, or fighting for cheap power, non-existent because of the Daniel Andrews government's love affair with weather-dependent energy, the state opposition leader has vowed to halve emissions by 2030. Now, that's an opinion piece, but the reason that it stood out to me is there seemed to be a complete lack of awareness of what is going to make people passionate to vote for the Liberal Party. You know, you can we can agree and disagree about you know, the comments he made on civil rights and cheap power, but it was almost like someone's guy coming out and saying, well, look, I'm going to do that too, but instead of you giving it infinity, I'm going to do infinity plus one. It's that sort of, it felt like almost that kindergarten level. And you feel like you've had all these issues that even if it's like when you go into a store and the person behind the counter, even if they're not feeling like doing it, they plaster on a fake smile. That's just how it goes. Even if the Liberal Party doesn't particularly believe in a number of things, they're not putting up something that's going to make people feel passionate about it, that's going to make them think, well, I'm going to change my vote, I'm going to change my opinion, I'm going to go actually give these guys a go. Instead, you get this, you know, this weak little wet, uninspiring, whenever I think of the Victorian Libs, all I can think of is adjectives that are just flaccid.
I think it also doesn't help that everything they do seems to just be, as you said, like everything the Victorian Libs do is just a variation on Labour. It's either an attack on Labour. Mm. It always kind of revolves around Victorian Labour Party. Nothing that they do sticks out as them. They're not individual. There's not anything there to make you differentiate them from anybody else. And when you're looking at like voting, what are you going to vote for? Are you going to vote for the party that you kind of like, oh, yeah, you've seen them, you know them, or the party that's basically another version of that party, but not as good?
Well, that's right. Well, the other thing as well is, and I'll be interested about this. So we are coming up to the next state election. Can you guys name three Labour Party policies? Like, or at least like kind of ideals. Like, what are they campaigning on?
Albert, I do not know because I'm not from Victoria.
Well, I'm
fair enough.
Yeah, I'm from Victoria, and as you know, I'm not sort of a policy wonk from you. So, my honest opinion is, I don't know at this stage. I couldn't tell you.
So,
Look, now really I'm imagining it's going to be it's going to be climate in there. There's going to be some version of, you know, getting Victoria towards a climate target. I don't know what they've set. Health has to be a large one in there. I think there's still going to be, I would still expect, you know, policies regarding COVID, but they're guesses. So my honest answer is, I don't know, Apricot.
Mm. So they're going to be pushing the suburban rail loop. They're going to be pushing 3-year-old kinder. Those are like
three-year-old
ones.
3-year-old kinder.
Yeah, 3-year-old. Yes, yeah, they're wow. Yeah, they're really pushing black government placements for that. And yeah, there'll probably be something around climate change as well. But you at least have a sort of idea what the Victorian ALP is going to be campaigning on. They're going to be campaigning on services and infrastructure.
Right.
I have no clue. I have absolutely no idea what the Victorian Liberals will be campaigning on, besides maybe the standard Liberal line of the debt, the budget, guys.
I did hear they've come out with an innovative emissions policy.
Have they?
Well, that three-year-old kinder one bothers me a bit, but that's not for this talk.
I'd get
but...
it if it was putting more funding into preschools. But I think that's. I don't know whether that kind of thing has been worded poorly, or it's. I could get it if it was like more funding to preschools and all that, but not if it's like, oh yeah, we're going to make 3-year-olds and oh, but it sounds like they're just going to make 3-year-olds go to school.
Go to- so here's the, like, I'm on the actual website for it. So, like, what you need to know, helping Victorian families. The Victorian government is investing $5 billion over the decade to deliver 15 hours of three-year-old kindergarten a week. This will be available in both standalone kindergartens and long daycare childcare centres. So, and then they list some, like, benefits to basically have, oh, wow, one of the benefits listed is they have higher exam scores at 16. Woo.
Also, that's my thing, that kind of thing of, like, judging exam scores on how smart a person is. So it doesn't work. I don't think that ever really truly judges how smart people are based on exam scores. Because I know people that are smart. But when it comes to those types of situations, like exams, that's so much pressure on a person. It's going to affect how you perform if there's so much pressure to do well. Like, that's why there's the whole, true. Like, thing of NAPLAN, how everyone goddamn hates NAPLAN, because it's so much pressure that you're putting on kids. Like, you're putting pressure of, like, tests and all that on kids. And those tests go to possibly how much funding schools can get if your school's not... Like, it's just... Mm-hmm. It's too much pressure for a child. Like, that's why I'm not the biggest fan of the HSC either in New South Wales. It's just kind of like... Especially when it means nothing after the first year of uni.
Well, as soon as you tie, as soon as you tie it to funding, it becomes a system to be gamed. That's just and there doesn't have to be any there doesn't have to be any evil intent behind it. It's just how humans are. If there's a reward and you can get a reward by cheating a little bit or cheating a lot, then humans will naturally be predisposed towards that. So look, what bothered me about it was, and this obviously driven by my view of government, but I would think if you had the mistrust of government that I do, it was a Malcolm X quote, only a fool would let his enemy teach his children. And that's why I pushed back against that. I thought, wow, three-year-old to get them into the system. That's probably more of a concern for me.
I just want to highlight a thing with NAPLAN, just a little, like, personal thing. My family despises NAPLAN, essentially, and my mother in particular really hates it and how it, like, works the school funding and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So she kept us all home on the days of the NAPLAN, like, as a general rule, except for my brother. Okay, once for my brother. Because now, my brother is not the sharpest tool in the shed, but he's much better with his hands and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I love him. But the school actually contacted our family and was like, hey, can you, like, not send him to school on NAPLAN Day?
Yeah.
Wow. Because, like, just in case, like, it, like, draws our scores down. And so mum then told him, no, you're going to go to school and I don't care how you do on the NAPLAN. Feel free to just, like, draw all over it or whatever.
But,
no.
Well, look, I mean, that's the sort of gaming that I'm talking about. You know, and how are you going to detect that? Just guess, okay, well, a student wasn't there, but bloody hell, that's a hide.
Yeah, so... NAPLAN needs to be removed. That's what I'll campaign on in the future. Just be like, abolish NAPLAN.
Because that's the thing of what because the thing is, NAPLAN doesn't show the true potential of children. It shows them in a specific subject. In the fact is, there's people that are smart people, but school and the way school's structured is just not for them. They can't learn like that. And, like, NAPLAN just doesn't teach that. Shit, it doesn't take any of that into account. And because it's so binary, it doesn't take into account how people learn or how people do in those situations. It doesn't take into account every other aspect of what makes a person smart or how education works.
And, like if we just use me as an example, like, I'm not too fantastic at math. I never particularly cared about it. But one thing after, like, entering the workforce is A, I always have a calculator, and B, one of my skills that wasn't really developed in high school, but you know, I do have, is like team leadership and things like that. Like, I'm really personable. I'm a really good communicator. You wouldn't think so based on the amount of I say. But I am very good at, well, for lack of a better phrase, greasing the wheels of office bureaucracy. But yeah, like those are skills that are not measured by NAPLAN in any capacity.
No, and I'm not sure how you could actually measure them. And it probably just comes to a fundamental flaw in mass production education, which is, you know, pretty much the case in most of the Western world. You know, it's essentially factory based, and obviously that's, again, a generalization. But if you can't measure something, then you can't manage it. So, mm-hmm. in many ways, the only way that they can manage the education system is by things that they believe they can measure effectively. But unfortunately, that just becomes a narrower focus till you get, you know, what Spence and yourself were talking about, where you get this narrow little band of a score where the score is essentially dictating everything. Hey, there's one point I wanted to make on the, or not wanted to make, that I thought was interesting that Spence had brought up. You said, Spence, that you thought the Liberal, Victorian Liberals might have become too comfortable. And I thought, yeah, there's that quote, in fact, that tied in with what you were saying, Apricot, about Victorian Liberals being the jewel in the crown. There's that quote that, you know, hard times create strong men create good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times. And I'm wondering if you actually did hit on what the reason may be.
We lost you there.
Oh, yeah. I was like,
you cut out at the end.
Was that? I thought I was going off then. I thought my.
Yeah, and maybe Reddit Talk had a bit of a conniption because I like couldn't unmute for a while.
We'll try.
Well, I think. See. No, I think maybe on that note, because we are getting close to midday.
Yeah.
We might look at wrapping up.
Adi's back.
Are you back?
Yeah. Where did you lose me?
I'm not entirely sure if I'm completely honest. Towards the end of
the start, you said about the journal recurring, and you made the point about the weak man and all that. I think that was kind of right after that was where.
Oh, right. So I was saying that I'm wondering actually, Spence, if you hit on the cause for the Liberal, the Victorian Liberals being so poor, so weak, because they simply have rest all in their laurels, enjoyed the good times too much, and we're just seeing a natural cycle. You know, it's struck a chord with me that you made the comment about them possibly being too comfortable, and Apricot, you'd made the comment about how they were considered the jewel, and that sounded like you could just sit back and preen yourself and not worry about the hard times ahead.
Yeah, I would say that's probably fairly accurate. I think it's also a little sad that the one person who I think might actually be able to lead the Victorian Liberals in a capable manner probably won't win at the state election because they're currently not in Parliament. But that's John Posato. He's recontesting his old seat of Hawthorn, but the Teals have announced that they're really planning on running a strong campaign there. And for those who don't know, the seat of Hawthorn and the suburb of Hawthorn was basically ground zero for Minnick Ryan's campaign. So if a Teal gets endorsed there, they're probably going to win.
Hmm. as you said, interesting times ahead. We've got the budget that's going to be the line in the sand with Labor. We've got the Victorian elections. We've got to see whether the Victorian Liberals actually pull anything interesting out of the hat. It's also going to be interesting, just to see how the final climate thing washes up.
Indeed. Well, thank you guys for joining us today. Again, apologies for being late, but I think we've had a pretty good discussion today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for
having me.
And thanks for being on too, Spence.
Awesome. Au revoir.
See you next Sunday.